just wanted to make sure.
Wait, he's not on yet.
Good morning, okay. Eric.
Good morning.
Sorry.
Ready? To you.
Good morning.
Good morning. This is Subcommittee on Human Services. This is April 28, 2015. We're going to, in a moment, open up a work session. We're going to have just a work session in block, so to speak. We're not going to open up for each of these reports. We got a whole bunch of reports to get through and pass on to full Ways and Means. Senator Steiner Haywood has graciously accepted all eight of them to carry in full because the chairs are going to be gone Friday of this subcommittee. And so I know you don't like to speak up very often. I know it's difficult for you. We're going to count on you to do this for us, okay?
Give me a break.
So I'm going to open up a work session then on a multitude of reports. Linda, you want to get us started?
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, as the chair said, we have eight reports today. The first three reports, you'll hear brief presentations. These are reports you have not yet heard during this session, although some of them came at least one other time during the interim. And then the last five, you actually heard the reports from DHS during their public hearings, but you never took formal action to acknowledge receipt of the report. So that's on the last five. Lori will just be summarizing, and we'll be taking the official action to send them to full.
And Lynn, if it's permissible, I'd like to just listen to all the reports and then in block send them to Ways and Means. Do we have to do each report separately?
Well, that would be fine, I think. You think we can do them all together to vote? I don't know that.
I would suggest we go ahead and take action on them individually.
No.
Unless we have a quorum issue with the subcommittee members being in and out.
All right.
We have a quorum issue already.
Let's hear the report first. The Oregon Health Authority Health Policy Programs Transformation Fund Report. You want to come up and give that to us, please?
Good morning, Co-Chair Bates.
Good morning.
Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Chris DeMars. I'm the Director of Systems Innovation at the Oregon Health Authority Transformation Center. Today I'll be presenting highlights from a report submitted to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, responding to a House Bill 3050-A budget note passed on June 28, 2013 that created the Health System Transformation Fund. Of the $30 million in the Health System Transformation Fund, $27 million provided a strategic investment in coordinated care organizations, or CCOs, to engage in projects that support better health care, and lower costs in their communities. This funding has resulted in 120 innovative projects spread across all 16 CCOs. In addition, OHA facilitated a discussion with the CCOs that resulted in all of them agreeing that $3 million of the fund be used to leverage up to 90% in federal funding to invest in statewide health information technology, or HIT. Today, I'll be providing more detail about both of these investments. This chart shows how the $27 million in the health and the transformation fund grants were spread across the 16 CCOs. According to the budget note, every CCO was eligible for a minimum award of $1.25 million with a possible additional allocation not to exceed $4 million for an individual CCO based on the CCO's average monthly Oregon Health Plan member count. OHA collaborated with CCOs to develop an application process and timeline to distribute funds to the CCOs. To develop proposals, 13 CCOs used a collaborative internal process, and the remaining three CCOs used all of their funds for a community grant program. All but two of the CCOs identified multiple projects. As you can see on this slide, four focus areas included projects for at least half of the CCOs. HIT, care coordination, including physical and behavioral health integration, patient-centered primary care homes, and community health, including traditional health workers. The Transformation Fund report includes an appendix with a detailed summary of all 120 projects. This slide highlights some of the goals the projects are designed to achieve, such as decreasing emergency room visits, enhancing primary and preventive care for patients, and decreasing healthcare costs by changing how providers are paid. The CCO submitted Transformation Fund progress reports to OHA in January, which included evaluation data for projects in an advanced stage of implementation. Some of the examples of outcomes included the following. Cascade Health Alliance implemented a mobile crisis team to respond on-site to mental health crises. 61 Oregon Health Plan members have been served, and data show a 59% reduction in mental health crisis visits to the emergency department from August to November 2014. Primary.
Excuse me. Mm-hmm. I think this question is going to come out of that one.
Mr. Morris, we actually heard a very interesting presentation on several different interesting mental health approaches to mental health in Marion and Lane County yesterday, and it makes me wonder. I mean, 59% decrease in emergency room visits is great. It depends on what your denominator is. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious about how many there were in the preceding period of time to which this was being compared. Because if we're talking about $1.4 million, which is what Cascade Health Alliance got, if we had 61 people served and we kept all of them out of the emergency department, well, that probably is about $1.4 million equal to that. But I'm curious about a little more detail there. Don't get me wrong. I'm all in favor of mobile crisis stuff and improved mental health services, but I want to understand the economics a little better. Was that what you were going to ask?
Yep.
Co-Chair Bates and Senator Steiner Hayward, that's an excellent question. I am going to have to work with my team and get back to you given the 120 projects, and I don't have that level of detail at my fingertips. So you'd like to know the denominator and kind of like what the math looks like, basically, correct?
Yeah, I mean, Okay. Don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to say that this is all about the numbers, mm-hmm. and it may be about building infrastructure this year that serves people in the long term, although these funds are going away. So the question is, how are they going to be maintained? You know, are they going to be maintained? Are we going to have invested all this money and then these new projects disappear? I don't know if your report, I haven't read it all yet, includes all that information about the long-term sustainability of the projects that were created using these one-time funds or what the deal is with that. So a little bit more information about that from my perspective would be very helpful.
And Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, I do note that Cascade had a number of different projects,
okay.
so it may have been a much smaller amount that went to that specific one.
Thank you.
That's very helpful. Yes, that's a good point.
Thank you very much.
Yep.
It's my fault for not having read the entire thing.
That's fine.
Yet, but.
All CCOs had multiple projects except for two.
Okay.
With regard to sustainability, I think I'll just address that now briefly. Within the report, the reports that this data came from that was submitted in January, OHA did not ask for sustainability plans yet. However, many of the CCOs noted some sustainability plans. There isn't one for this project in particular, but some have received outside grants. The CCOs have agreed to provide additional funding, and we expect with the final report that will be submitted, we will get information on sustainability.
Got it.
In addition, some of the projects won't necessarily require sustainability because the funds were used for startup costs for HIT or certification programs to get patient-centered primary care, you know, clinics into the patient-centered primary care certification, trainings, that sort of thing.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Primary. Just a second. I'm going to follow up for just for a second.
Sure.
Please give us the full report when you get a chance to. Those of us who are deeply involved in this want to see that. The point of this of the crisis team being paid out of this money when the other money should have been coming from AMH raises questions in my mind how this money is flowing. It's a great thing you did. Mm-hmm. I'm glad it was done. Shows what can be done. Also, we have sustainable money coming from the provider tax. I read the report from the hospitals last night how they're doing hitting their marks as far as money flowing through from that. So I'd really like to have a lot more detail on this if you have a chance. So I don't want to take up a lot of time. We're really short time today to look at this, but it's really where the rubber's meeting the road, and we need that information because it helps set our budget for us.
Okay.
So I appreciate if you can get more to us later on.
And you mean about this project in particular and
no,
all the
No, I mean
all
across the board.
Well.
I wonder where that $30 million went, what it was done, what was done with it, how it crossed different lines, and you know, it's the kind of thing we want to be doing.
Yep.
And there's probably more money coming in from the provider tax to do some of this, because there's a 1% set up for hospitals, and someone's going to flow across CCOs. They're going to be doing projects together, obviously. So I want to know more about this and get a better picture of what actually happened.
Mm-hmm.
I assume they did some great stuff, but we want to know.
Okay.
And let's try to fund it. I'm on a campaign here. I'm worried about the rates that are going to be set here with for OHA, and I'm still very concerned they're being set too low. And this kind of stuff all goes away, and we start going in the wrong direction again in health care costs.
Mm-hmm.
So continue. Okay? Sorry.
Okay. Sure. I just want to point out, Co-Chair Bates, so we will absolutely get you the report. It has been officially submitted, and we'll make sure that you
get
that. And whatever questions you have that aren't answered to the report, we will be happy to answer them for you.
Thank you.
So just to clarify, though, is the report that's in OLIS right now, the 32-page report, is that the report that you're talking about?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, we'll just pull that one up. Thanks.
Okay.
I just want to make sure if there wasn't a different one that we need that had more detail or something.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sure. So will you give me a note about time in terms of, because I have five more projects I wanted to provide detail about, but if, okay. So Primary Health of Josephine County launched a maternal medical home for women at highest risk of poor birth outcomes. The data from the January report show an 18% increase in access to the first prenatal visit and a 42% decrease in the cesarean delivery rate.
That's a big deal.
Should I continue?
Yeah, continue.
Okay.
Keep going.
We're all ears.
All right. Family Care supported the care coordination and community-based partnerships for homeless youth served at Portland metro area clinics. As a result, over 300 homeless youth have gained access to services such as primary and preventive care, which is that they didn't have access to previously. HealthShare of Oregon expanded capacity for 15 primary care physicians through Project ECHO, or Extension for Community Healthcare Outcomes. It's an evidence-based telementoring program with mental health specialists that increases primary care providers' capacity and ability to deliver mental health care. Pacific Source Gorge has partnered with Meals on Wheels to provide meals at home to all Oregon Health Plan members that were discharged from the hospital. 243 meals have been served. There have been no rehospitalizations or infections, and all clients report satisfaction with services. And finally, as part of its comprehensive shared care plan initiative to integrate care, Trillium Community Health Plan implemented a community health worker program, which shows $2.70 savings for every dollar that was invested. So these, once again, is just a highlight, six of the 120 projects that were funded through the Transformation Fund grant program. Using the January progress reports I've mentioned, OHA analyzed and categorized the projects into three stages of implementation. About a quarter of the projects are at the early stage of implementation, half are in the middle stage and have just begun to collect evaluation data, and the final quarter are in an advanced stage of implementation, having collected enough data to inform next steps for spread and sustainability. Confirming the analysis showed in this slide, many CCOs reported challenges in implementing the Transformation Fund grants by the end of the biennium, or June 30th, 2015. As relatively new organizations, CCOs are still building their organizational structures, hiring and onboarding new staff to manage the funds and creating new subcontracts has taken a significant amount of time. In addition, CCOs have reported delays interfacing with contractors such as HIT vendors. While OHA is confident that all transformation funds will be paid to the CCOs by June 30th, 2015, many CCOs requested extensions to expend their grant funds through subrecipients and to complete the projects. Consequently, 13 CCOs have received OHA director approval for a six-month extension through December 31st, 2015. Extensions will allow time for CCOs to fully implement proposed projects and gather meaningful evaluation data. To help support project implementation and spread innovative best practices to other CCOs, the OHA Transformation Center developed a learning collaborative to support all CCOs Transformation Fund portfolio managers. The learning collaborative has involved two trainings on the science of quality improvement and CCO site visits by Transformation Center staff to review and provide guidance on their metrics and evaluation plans. The health information technology work described in the next two slides is under OHA's Office of HIT. Leslie Clement and Susan Otter described this work when presenting to this committee on OHA's health policy and programs budget on April 6th. We know several of you are interested in further discussions on HIT, and Susan's team is working on to schedule follow-up meetings with those of you who expressed interest. To provide context for this body of work, OHA had engaged in a strategic planning process in 2013, which identified a core set of HIT services that would add value at the state level. Then, as mentioned earlier, in August 2013, all 16 CCOs agreed that OHA could hold out $3 million of the Transformation Fund dollars to leverage significant federal Medicaid match to invest in statewide HIT investments. The CCOs were particularly interested in HIT that could be best offered at the state level. These slides describe the services that OHA has invested in using the $3 million. Current services that have been implemented already include basic statewide health information exchange functionality through direct secure messaging, and statewide hospital notifications through the Emergency Department Information Exchange, or EDI. All 59 hospitals in the state of Oregon have agreed to participate in EDI, and 55 are already live. Two services are coming online this year. The first is called PreManage, which allows CCOs and other Medicaid coordinators to access EDI real-time alerts for their patient or member lists. In addition, technical assistance will be available to Medicaid providers in using electronic health records and seeking federal incentive payments. And finally, two services are in development with funding already secured: a state-level provider directory to support operations, analytics, and health information exchange, and a statewide clinical quality data registry for collecting CCO quality metrics data from electronic health records. So that ends my presentation. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
I'm just going to make a couple of quick statements real quickly here. First off, I'm getting information from providers that the Transformation Center is getting pretty high marks.
Thank you very much, Co-Chair Bates.
And I checked up with some of the ER docs about the EDI system, and they really use it, like it, and say it works well, which in this state, having an IT system that works well is kind of a shocking occurrence. Okay. They did ask for a faster way to get into the prescription monitoring information, and I'll talk to Susan Otter about that later. It's something they can do now, it's just a little clumsy. The other thing that I found out by asking around also was that the promise of actually being able to exchange records on patients electronically is starting to actually happen in some areas. My area is particularly, and some other parts of the state also. Mm-hmm. It's real time, it's real information. The problem doesn't seem to be technological this time, it seems to be political. That some systems don't want to let go of their information, they're worried about it going to the wrong place, and so they're slow coming online with some things. You know, certain healthcare systems don't want to release information on a patient to other systems, and we need to build those portals quickly and easily. I can get information, as an example, faster out of OHSU on a patient right now in Medford, Oregon, than I can out of the Providence system, which I can drive over, pick the information up, and drive back. We've actually done that a few times. It actually saves time because you can't do it electronically. And so that's the kind of stuff we have to get around. But you guys are doing, from what I've heard, you're doing a good job, and I appreciate your hard work.
Thank you very much, Co-Chair Bates.
Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with all those sentiments. Thank you for your work. And also, we are having a hearing on the 30th to look at the interplay between CCOs and counties with regard to reducing obesity and tobacco prevention. Mm-hmm. So the idea of really going upstream and changing the environment in which people live as opposed to the focus on individuals, and the recognition that these are public health issues that affect not only the CCO population. So I just want to get that on your radar in case there's anything. We have several CCOs who are doing innovative things I'm sure with a lot of support from the Transformation Center. So just to make sure that you know, so any ideas that you have that you want to make sure are highlighted, you can sprinkle through the invited speakers, which Linda Ames can help. It's not there, the speakers are not yet identified, but we know who they are. They're not identified online, publicly.
Today.
Maybe. It will go up. But anyway, we just want to make sure that's on your radar, because I think you have a Transformation Center has a lot to do with helping promote that, and particularly if the counties, as proposed, may lose some of the TPEP funding for tobacco, we want to make sure that the money that's going to the CCOs for tobacco prevention really is working closely with the counties who have been doing a lot of that work in the past.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other comments? Seeing none? Chair Nathanson.
Thank you. Ready for a motion?
Absolutely.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I move that we acknowledge receipt of a report on the Health System Transformation Fund.
We have a motion before us. Anybody opposed? Any discussion? Seeing none, so moved. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next is the Department of Human Services, Aging and People with Disabilities, Senior Mental Health Report. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Jane Ellen Wyance with the Department of Human Services, Aging and People with Disabilities, and I'm the APD Medicaid Long-Term Care Manager.
Good morning. My name is Ralph Summers. I'm with the Oregon Health Authority's Addictions and Mental Health Division, and the report that we're speaking about is a joint report.
So we'll be going through some of the highlights of the report. You have it submitted, and we're not going to read you the 8 pages of details, but we'll be highlighting some of the changes we've made over this biennium. Do you
want to? Chairs, members of the committee, the two offices that we represent that are now in two different departments have a long history of working together primarily on facility-based specialty care, and the things that you will see in the report that we will highlight a sample of represent an effort to try to expand to earlier intervention, health promotion, the kinds of upstream interventions that were mentioned just a few minutes ago.
Really working on a continuum of care from detection, early intervention, all the way through intensive supports for people with mental illness, dementia, traumatic brain injury. As an example, we were able to increase our enhanced care services program this biennium to serve people who are both eligible for aging and people with disability services and also have a co-occurring mental illness. The community mental health program provides mental health services in long-term care facilities in that program. And we've also been able to expand jointly with addictions and mental health services for people with traumatic brain injury and mental illness and or dementia, really providing in more intensive services for those people who cannot be served effectively in our other long-term care settings. We've also been able to expand gatekeeper services throughout the state. And gatekeeper services are really using community partners such as letter carriers, meter readers, those kinds of people that are in communities every day to identify people who may be at risk, a change. So all of a sudden somebody's not mowing their lawn or they never come out and say hi or those kinds of things. And the gatekeeper program through the Aging and Disability Resource Connections allows us the opportunity to train those people in communities, help them identify people who are at risk, and then they can report those to the ADRCs so that we can intervene as appropriately and get out there and check in on individuals. So we've been able to expand that statewide. And we also have been able to create and are, in many cases, really doing robust services for people, mostly older adults and younger people with disabilities, who are at risk for anxiety, depression, and or addiction services as well. And we're using that through the ADRCs and using evidence-based and promising practices to really intervene before somebody would need intensive mental health services. And we've expanded that statewide. Some programs are really doing very well and are, you know, clicking right along, and others are still in the process of getting up to speed, and they've worked throughout their ADRC partnerships to develop these new programs.
Can I ask a question?
Question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you say something else about the gatekeepers? Are these paid people? How do you identify them? How do you train them?
Chair Bates and Representative Jenny Geyer, sorry. The gatekeepers are usually the ADRCs have a staff person or two that do public presentations, work with developing partners, and then the individuals in the community are just doing this in their normal job, like a letter carrier with the U.S. Postal Service or bank tellers, et cetera, that they're interacting with older adults throughout the community. They're not being paid, they're volunteers. Mm-hmm. And then when they make a report, paid staff intervene and go out and do a wellness check for those individuals.
Okay, thank you. Do we have
numbers on what we're hearing back from folks and the uptake and all that kind of stuff?
Chairman Bates, Senator Steiner, how you word? Sorry, I'm really nervous today for some reason. So
we don't bite.
We're throwing
I know,
a lot of hard names at you.
And you don't have rotten tomatoes, so I know that.
No,
so
we're all good.
We can get you numbers. I didn't bring them today.
I'd be interested just to see how this is working out in the communities. And I mean, I think these kinds of programs are really cool. We've done them with having hairdressers talk to people about hypertension, right?
Yeah.
Diabetes and people that people see all the time. It's pretty cool to engage more people in the community in very entrained ways. I like these kinds of programs a lot.
We'll get you updated numbers for both programs.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, one of the joint activities that was authorized by the fall emergency board was an appropriation of $3.1 million to hire 25 FTE to be employed throughout the state to be trained and served as older adult behavioral health specialists, not so much as direct service practitioners, but as people that have three primary categories of duties. One is to facilitate training and improve the capability of the specialty behavioral health system to serve both older adults and younger adults with disabling conditions that aren't psychiatric. The second area is to make sure that the community can provide specialty consultation, help make sure that people don't get stuck in the hospital, try to pull everybody together about what to do with those extremely challenging or patients that have challenging circumstances. And the third category is to make sure that all the agencies develop a good catalog of what's available in this community and then do joint planning and prioritization of how are we going to expand and develop new resources and what are our priorities in this community. Those hirings are continuing. About half of those people are hired. It's a very challenging specialty. So it's like hire somebody or hire a smart person and train them. And in a few minutes, I'll tell you a little bit, both Janelle and I'll talk a little bit about the Portland State University's Institute on Aging that has an excellent a training curricula that we're getting ready to start delivering at the end of this month. And though our contract will expire at the end of the biennium, we are working together to make sure that that organization provides curricula for multiple audiences that'll be available online so that people in their home communities can access it after they've been trained to recreate community-based trainings to raise all boats.
So why don't we go right there? So jointly together with Addictions and Mental Health and the funding that you provided during this biennium, we are working in collaboration to make sure that we're raising the bar for everybody and providing training from direct staff and case management staff and direct caregivers throughout the system. And what we're really trying to do is make sure that we're not duplicating work, but that we're building on work. So the curriculum that Addictions and Mental Health has been working with Portland State University to develop and rolling out right now this month, we will be carrying on into next biennium if the funding comes available, but building on that and continuing to expand the training around dementia, older adults with mental illness, traumatic brain injuries, ensuring that both delivery systems understand each other and have common language on how to serve folks, and developing stronger partnerships locally so that we can get referrals and hopefully develop a seamless approach so that individuals get the services they need right when they need them. We've been doing a lot of work, and as you can see, you gave us a great challenge this biennium, I've got to say, with the budget note, and I think that we've been doing pretty fantastic work together, really working to interlink our systems and develop that full continuum, and we're happy to answer any questions that you may have about the specifics in the report.
Thanks. Just a quick couple of things here. I saw in the analysis done by Linda Laurie that you trained 2,200 gatekeepers, which is a pretty good number to get started with, and appreciate that. Number two, though, there's a point here about working with enhanced care services to prevent people from going into the state hospital or getting them out afterwards. Mm-hmm. And has there been an expansion of beds available? Can you tell us a bit more about that program? It says that you had a capacity of 152 beds in one area and 96 in another. Are they spread across the state? Where are they? What's going on?
So, Chair Bates, the enhanced care program has two components. One is a facility-based program where the long-term care services and the mental health services are co-located. And we call that enhanced care services. And we were able to expand that by 10 beds this biennium, really serving additional individuals who either are being diverted from the state hospital or are discharging from the state hospital. The other component is enhanced care outreach services. So these are for services for individuals in APD's typical long-term care settings, and mental health sends people into that program to serve one or two individuals instead of being co-located.
And co-chairs, members of the committee, I'm going to hand it back to you in just a second,
sure.
But the modest expansion of the traditional enhanced care program is only partly helpful. That serves people that are eligible for long-term care in a residential care facility or a nursing facility by bringing in daily in-house mental health programming. The more challenging populations to serve are people that don't have a traditional psychotic or depressive disorder, but they have a traumatic brain injury or a type of dementia that allows them to be very difficult to be served in the long-term care system as it exists. And much of the expansion that you've done that has helped us with preventing people from coming to the state hospital or helping to discharge people has been the expanding of behavioral consultation and supports that advise caregivers on how to adapt to changing needs of people that have these kind of predictable neurological disorders that are going to get worse, as opposed to a psychotic disorder that can be rehabilitated and have symptoms decrease.
So we did also expand services for in community-based care, so residential care facilities, not with the mental health program, but really targeting our skilled providers to develop programs with behavioral support interventions, more medical interventions, and really working with people with challenging behaviors that are often evicted from other settings, and bringing together really high-skilled workers to support those individuals in community-based care.
And this is an area that we hope to be able to expand on as we look to the future. These are the kinds of investments that will really help the entire system be able to work better. In the past, it's been, well, where can this person go? But now we're trying to put systems together that say, what supports does this person and their provider need in order to be able to get over this difficult time rather than moving people? And that's going to be lower cost per person and more effective in the long run.
And just to put you guys use words that are very nice, but let me kind of put it in reality here, okay, because I deal with that reality. We're seeing an increased number of elderly people become demented. Mm-hmm. We know that's going to happen. It's not going to change. Many of them are what we call pleasantly demented. They're demented and confused, but they're very gentle souls and easy to deal with. Many of them, unfortunately, become very angry, sometimes abusive, and are not in immediate danger themselves or others, but just can't be managed. We're seeing more and more nursing homes starting to develop wings for that, but they need a lot of support to keep them there. And the families in places like Bedford would rather have them kept there, so they can still visit with them and not have them at the state hospital. The cost difference is huge, of course, You know, I mean, it's probably $80,000-$90,000 a year at a nursing home for this kind of care, and $300,000 state hospital, which is very difficult for people. So I think that's what you're talking about here. You're talking about giving more help to those dementia wings, those Alzheimer wings, and residential facilities, and some of which are not nursing homes, they're residential facilities, where they have to have a sort of a lock-up type of thing so people don't wander out of the building and get lost and get hurt. We've had problems with that, too. And so that's the kind of program you're trying to develop. I applaud you for doing that. We really need to keep pushing it hard. We don't need to have geriatric wings at the state hospital.
Chair Bates, I totally agree with you, and I think one of the things our current residential capacity in our system through residential care facilities, assisted living facilities, and our nursing facilities do a really good job with the memory care individuals. It's that special group of people who are very challenging. They may be explosive. They may unfortunately swing at people as they walk by. They may not be eating appropriately. So we're really developing that additional cadre of more intensive services on top of our existing programs. And it's working really well. We're seeing that those programs that we're developing are serving these individuals with advanced dementia, with challenging behaviors, and or traumatic brain injuries. They're doing a really good job with those folks.
Thank you. Questions? Have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move that we acknowledge receipt of the report on mental health services for seniors and people with disabilities.
Thank you. We have a motion before us. Any discussion? Any opposition? Seeing none, so moved. Thank you for your report.
Thank you
for your work. Next is the Department of Human Services, Aging and People with Disabilities, Oregon Project Independence Pilot.
Is it loaded? Hello.
Hi, Larry. Will lead us through this?
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, my fellow co-worker just informed me that the department, or they did bring forward a presentation today that I was unaware of, so I think they have something to put up on the screen. This is a report back to you that came out of an investment that was made from the Senior Special Purpose Appropriation to test a pilot project for expanding Oregon Project Independence for younger people with disabilities, and so they're back to give you information on how that pilot work has gone.
Good morning, Co-Chair Bates. Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the subcommittee. I'm Ashley Carson Cottingham. I'm the Deputy Director for Aging and People with Disabilities at the Department of Human Services, and I'm joined here today by...
Good morning, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rodney Schroeder. I'm the Executive Director for Operations for Northwest Senior and Disability Services. It's a local area agency on aging, serving Marion Polk, Yamhill, Clatsop, and Tillamook. Also the current chair of O4AD, the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities.
If I may, Mr. Co-Chair, the presentation is not in OLIS because we didn't get it ahead of time, so I don't think you'll find it. So, but you will find the LFO analysis, you'll find the report, and then there is actually a third document, which is some simple information from the AAAs that they provided. So there is a reference document there, but you're not going to see the PowerPoint because it hasn't been loaded in the system yet.
We apologize for that. We had a little communication breakdown, but we promised to get it to you right away.
We'll get it loaded, yes, but you won't find it on your screen.
Sorry about that. So we're here to discuss the Oregon Project Independence pilot project for adults with disabilities. In 2005, the legislature amended the law for Oregon Project Independence to expand to cover adults ages 19 to 59. And the statute prohibited the adoption of rules around expansion until OPI, Oregon Project Independence funding, was quote-unquote sufficient. So we embarked upon the pilot project effective July 1 of 2014. House Bill 5201 authorized funding and directed DHS to develop a pilot project. So you'll see on this slide we have the pilot steering committee up on the screen. DHS ended up selecting 7 area agencies on aging to participate in the Oregon Project Independence expansion pilot. And then we contracted with one of the 7, Northwest Senior and Disability Services, Rodney's organization, as the lead entity to manage the project. And the 7 area agencies on aging that were selected serve a diverse geographic area of urban, rural, and frontier counties. And those are Benton, Clatsop, Jackson, Josephine, Lane, Lynn, Lincoln, Marion, Morrow, Multnomah, Pope, Umatilla, Washington, and Yamhill.
The next slide is going to go into some of the demographics and some of the data that we've identified so far in the pilot. We've been running the pilot now about 10 months. The data that's in front of you on the screens is data that's about at the 9.5 month mark. So it's around the April 16th mark. And what you'll notice there is some demographic and data that's very consistent and very close to the regular, what we call the regular OPI program, and that's the program that serves folks that are 60 and older. Some of the highlights there that are mentioned, though, the majority of participants, 73%, are between the ages of 50 and 59. We've identified 77% of them are still at a fairly low income level of $1,500 a month, and 78% of them are reporting low assets or low liquid assets that would be available for use of for their care, of less than $10,000 for an individual or $15,000 for the couples. Three-fourths of the folks live alone, and then 73% are scoring moderate to high risk for an out-of-home placement. That out-of-home placement is a risk assessment that's completed by the area agency for the on the individuals. It's an evidence-based model that's out of Minnesota, and it identifies some of the risks that would perhaps require that person to go out of home or into a facility for some type of care. And again, 73% of them are scoring moderate to high risk for that. And then 30% of the
question
of the members.
Representative Nathan.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to make a comment and invite your response. So that's about three-quarters are scoring moderate to high for out-of-home placement. And the way I interpret that, and just to sort of underscore this, it's that in addition to being emotionally and socially less satisfying to have to leave the home, it would also cost a lot more money. Are both of those true?
So, Co-Chair Bates, Co-Chair Nathanson, that's correct. So that indeed both statements are correct. And what that risk assessment does is it identifies things like falls in the past 6 months. It identifies whether or not they feel safe. It identifies an income or resource limit so that if they had to go into facility, how quickly they would go through or spend down. But your statements are correct.
Thank you. That's significant.
Thank you. By the way, if those who want to follow, I'm looking at the LFO report, which I think is a summation of what you're telling us about, too. It's a good report. Thank you, Lori.
Correct, Co-Chair. So the detailed report that's on OLIS or that's been submitted, the data and the reports that I'm going through are pulled out of that report. And then again, the bottom bullet there, 30% of these folks have reported having a fall with injuries within the past 6 months. Next slide. So the continuing on, this chart shows the seven pilot areas down the left-hand column listed by the counties in which these pilots were done. As Ashley mentioned earlier, there's a mix of both urban and rural counties involved. The middle column is the current number of consumers as of April 16th, broke down by each of those areas that are served, for a total of 321 consumers are currently on the pilot. And then the far right-hand column is a projection on what the pilot areas are anticipating and what the growth rate has been, a projection by the end of June, at the end of this biennium, at the conclusion of the pilot, anticipated to have about 464 consumers on the pilot.
So this next slide might look familiar to you. Our director, Mike McCormick, briefly discussed this framework in the February overview presentation. It shows our service eligibility criteria, and this is what the department and our AAA partners use to assess service priority level for both Medicaid long-term services and supports and for the OPI, or Oregon Project Independence Program. Currently, our Medicaid long-term services and support system pays for individuals assessed levels 1 through 13, and we're able to serve more people through the higher service priority levels, so we can serve OPI individuals anywhere from 1 through 18 on this chart.
So the following slide identifies a breakout of where the OPI consumers on the pilot fall within that service priority level. The service priority level is derived by that functional assessment that Ashley mentioned. It identifies how well an individual can meet their activities of daily living and instrumental activities of daily living. And as Ashley mentioned, levels 1 through 13 are an existing SPL functional eligibility for Medicaid. And as the chart indicates there, about 55% of the OPI pilot consumers are in levels 1 through 13. The remainder then are in levels 14 through 18. And again, the lower the level, the more impaired or more needs that the individual has, the lower the number. The next slide will go through some of the average costs that we've seen as we've looked at it. The average across the board, across all SPLs, equates to about $335 per month for the individual consumers on the pilot. Those in the higher needs, that's an SPL of 3 or lower, are averaging $422 a month costs. And then for the consumers with the fewer needs or those higher number SPLs, the example here is an SPL 18. Those consumers are averaging $276 per month in service.
We wanted to share a couple consumer profile stories with you today just to give you an example of who's being served in the pilot. So I'll start with a story about a consumer who's a 51-year-old woman. She lives alone in subsidized apartments on an income of $771 per month. She's homebound and only leaves her home for shopping and errands about once a month due to extreme anxiety, PTSD, and painful mobility. In addition to these issues, she suffers from obesity, malnutrition, knee injuries, and joint pain. She also gets fatigued and dizzy and is easily overwhelmed by her daily tasks of care. She has a recent history of falling in the shower and was bathing only once a week out of fear of falling again. She was assessed through the pilot at service priority level 13. She has no family in the area, and she was referred to the AAA, the Area Agency on Aging, by a concerned neighbor who knew that she was falling frequently and noticed that she was never leaving the house. The consumer was hesitant to accept services at first because she was concerned about dealing with strangers coming into her home. But the AAA started working with her, and they started slowly, and she agreed to try some home-delivered meals. And then she agreed to accept 26 hours of housekeeping and personal care assistance per month. And the outcome is now her home is clean. She's able to safely shop for groceries and to pick up all of her necessary medications. And she really likes having a home care worker. And this has provided her with some positive social interaction. She reports being really grateful for the services and is happy to be receiving help that she desperately needs. She said that before this OPI, before the OPI pilot services became available, she was feeling hopeless and alone, and now she feels cared for and hopeful. She said that having a home care worker has given her positive social interaction, and that she's feeling healthy and clean now that someone can assist her.
So our other profile and example of a consumer is a male in his 50s. He suffers from complex regional pain syndrome, which causes significant pain and mobility issues. His income is approximately $922 a month, and this gentleman lives alone, has difficulty maintaining his home and having any social interaction. He was assessed at a service priority level 17. Now with the assistance of the OPI pilot, he's been set up with a motorized scooter, and he receives in-home care of about 25 hours per month. This service then has enabled him to continue to live in his home more independently with a better quality of life. The consumer also plans to return to volunteering with a local charity to help others that are in need as well.
And that brings us to our recommendation. So the department believes that a biennial appropriation of at least $27.5 million will suffice to meet the criteria listed in the statute in ORS 410-435. And so if we wanted to, if you wanted to make this program age neutral, that's the appropriation that we think would be necessary. And it assumes that approximately 21.5 million will be used for the 60 and older population, and approximately 6 million would be used by individuals who are 19 to 59.
And then if I could point out in the written product that's on OLIS, it goes into good information around the sufficient funding and such. And the dollars that are presented here as both the regular OPI program and this pilot grows with the need, and then as this pilot, should you choose to move to more statewide instead of just the pilot areas, we possibly would get to a point where there could be some waiting list and such as well as we work through the prioritization of those most in need. So the level of funding that we have now begins to meet that need, but over time and with growth and with expansion, we could get back at a place where we're at wait list.
Questions? Representative Kinnegar.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. Thank you. This is it's great to hear. It's both humane and it makes a lot of sense financially. I'm just thinking a lot about the Nepal disaster right now, and I know that one of the things that really helps people in disaster recovery is that when the people who are the victims of the disaster not only receive help, but as soon as they're put to work in helping others in that disaster, it's really critically important for their own rehabilitation and moving forward. So I love the story about the guy in the 50s who is turning around and volunteering for other things.
Thank you.
What would help the committee also on this would be if you can give us information about what you think avoidance of cost is. If these programs aren't continued, how many of these people would fall back into a situation where they're on Medicaid programs we have to fund? Generally speaking, OPI is not funded with any federal dollars. It's strictly a general fund program, but just because it's not matched money doesn't mean it shouldn't be continued. Even matched money costs us something, and if this is a program that is not only humane but actually just substantially chase general fund dollars we have to use for Medicaid match, that would be helpful information in making a decision.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, just to clarify, the report before you today is not to take, you're not trying to take action on the recommendation made. And I just wanted to let you know that you have had discussion about the department's budget and what was in the governor's budget. And the governor's budget is not at the level that's a part of this recommendation that the folks are mentioning before you today. But I know that folks are well aware of the need or desire to potentially continue to fund the program and what that cost is. That's definitely on people's radar.
Thank you, Laurie. I appreciate your comments in your report, too, so that just enhances it. Yes?
Laurie, can you remind us what the governor's recommended budget is for this?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Kinnegar, the governor's recommended budget does not have funding for the pilot project or an expanded program in it. It continues to cover the existing level of for regular Oregon Project Independence. And just as a reminder, as Senator Bates mentioned, one of the criteria for Oregon Project Independence of eligibility is that you're not Medicaid eligible. So the people in this program would not be eligible for Medicaid services, at least at this point in their life continuum. And I think part of the reasoning behind having the program is to try and delay some of that Medicaid eligibility further into the future by providing intervention sooner has been one of the philosophies behind having the program to begin with. So to get to the program to this level that was mentioned in front of the committee today, we need another $6 or $7 million into the budget to support the expanded program at the age neutral capacity.
Thank you. And the reason I asked the question about avoiding costs is that can drive these decisions in a specific direction, obviously, and we need those kind of numbers to have an idea of what the best approach is.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
I move to acknowledge receipt of the report.
Thank you. We have a motion before us. Any discussion? Any questions? Any opposition? Seeing none, we accept the report. Thank you.
Thank you.
So we've heard the rest of these reports already. So
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, I want to briefly remind you that there's five other reports. Even though you saw them before and you had them in your OLS materials previously, we did go ahead and include the reports again today. I've also included a copy of the LFO analysis. So just as a quick reminder, you heard when the department was before you talking about the Aging and People with Disabilities program, you heard a report on some activities that were paid for with some of the senior special purpose appropriation funding. You heard a report on the Ready to Work registry, which has to do with registering people who are working in elder care situations and facilities. You also heard a report on a general assistance study, and there is a piece of legislation that has been sent to Ways and Means that would put into place a general assistance pilot project. So that's something that may end up coming before the committee before the end of session, but the pilot project and program is tied to a piece of legislation. You heard a report on that. You also heard a report related to a budget note on direct care wages, which dealt with sort of the landscape as far as providers in both the APD and IDD systems and how they get paid and what their fringe benefits are. There was a huge report that came along with that that you were exposed to. And then you finally heard a report on child welfare staffing. That was also out of a budget note from last session. There were some investments made in the child welfare program as far as staffing, and they came back and reported on what that staffing looks like and some of the outcomes that have started to develop as they've had that enhanced level of staffing. If you want, if you don't want to have any more discussion on this, we could probably go ahead and accept or take action on those reports in block if you'd like to do it that way.
Question, Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you. Lori, do you know when the General Assistance Study report was? We heard that.
We heard the first four reports on February 11th in subcommittee, and the Child Welfare Staffing report we heard on February 26th.
February 11th.
You know that.
I wrote it down. Okay. Thank you.
Remembered it. Any other questions about the reports? I will entertain a motion then.
Mr. Chair, I move that we acknowledge receipt of all of the reports just described by LFO.
We have a motion before us. Any discussion? Any opposition? Hearing none, so moved. Kidding aside, thank you for taking all this on.
Fine.
I feel kind of abandoning you on Friday.
It's fine.
So
don't worry about
it. All these reports.
None of these,
present.
I hope, are too complicated or controversial because I have a track record of carrying controversial things in full. But
maybe Mr. Rocco can put them on the consent agenda or something.
That would be lovely. Maybe Ms. Byerly can talk about it.
Mr. Rocco. I will see what I can do.
I appreciate that.
Co-chair, Senator Hayward, but I don't know where we are as far as a consent agenda for Friday.
Okay.
So.
Okay.
I'll make the pony short.
That'd be lovely.
That I can do.
Thank you.
I can control that.
And I will talk to the co-chairs about it, too. But I do appreciate
it. It's not a big deal. I'm being silly. I don't mind. I can take as many as you need me to. It's not a big deal.
But thank you. It's very nice of you to do it.
No, I'm happy to do it.
I do appreciate it. So I think our business is done today.
Tomorrow, we'll need to have you here again, a quorum of possible because there's a work session on a grant as well as the Psychiatric Security Review Board budget. I believe that's the first budget you're actually getting to take action on this session. And then Thursday, there's going to be the meeting that Representative Kenny Geyer mentioned earlier on obesity and tobacco, I believe, the topics for Thursday.
So. Okay. So I think we're done, and we are therefore I'll close the work session and then close the committee meeting. Thank you very much for your time. And close the committee meeting. Thank you very much for your time. Session.